everyone. I'm Scott.
And I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that we see beneath the surface.
Yes. And this is episode number 13.
Ooh, lucky 13.
Lucky 13. And we're going to talk about Prince of Foxes, a historical novel by Samuel Shellabarger.
Yes, this was my choice.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my parents had this and The Captain from Castile always sitting around the house for some reason. And so when I was a teenager, I discovered these books and just fell in love with them. They mm-hmm. tell a wonderful story, and they're very richly written.
When you say these books, are they connected in some way, or are they each standalone?
Just by the author. They're standalone mm-hmm. books. And as it turns out, I very briefly looked him up on Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. Thank you for Wikipedia. Samuel Shellabarger began writing these historical books fairly late in life. He was 50 when he began writing.
Mm-hmm.
And he had written some other works before, but the historical ones were completely new for him. And I can't remember which one was first. It may have been this one.
Mm-hmm.
But he also wrote The Captain of Castile, which was his best known one. It was made into a movie. And I didn't look it up, but I have some foggy memory of somebody like Gregory Peck in it, you know, that kind of historical movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's about a young man during the Spanish Inquisition who winds up traveling with Cortez to conquer the Aztecs.
Oh,
and
interesting.
And mm-hmm. there's Lord Vanity, which is set in Venice and England, about a young man. It's always a young man, which is, of course, the most interesting perspective to show things from as they learn. But he is an actor born into a artistic family who finds out he has a ne'er-do-well. It was his one slip, a very respectable father. So he's got to choose between those worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one, it's set in, I think, Bourbon, France. And it's when France is going to be unified under one king. And it's a little further along than this book in talking about unification, in that the king has taken over almost all of the independent states. And this young man has to choose between his family, who favors staying loyal to their duke, and the vision of a unified country when the ruler might not be exactly what you'd hope for.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, each of them has romances and that sort of thing. I can't remember the name, but it's easy to find somewhere.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed when I was looking up this book, Prince of Foxes, that it, too, was a movie. I haven't had a chance to watch it, but it's a movie from 1949.
Okay.
Starring Tyrone Power, Orson Welles, and someone named Wanda Hendricks.
Oh.
And on IMDb, it's got a really pretty decent rating, 7 out of 10. You know, so it might be worth checking out.
I know. I don't know why I never looked them up. But you could see how it would. It's got a scope that is made for movies. Basically, we meet a young man, Andrea Orsini, and it's set in Italy when there are only independent states and not really a unified country. And he is...
Yeah, I found one of the passages that I marked, if I could interrupt just for one second, was just a quick description of Italy at the time. It said, England. Okay, so this is right around 1500. England, France, and Spain, under the leadership of able princes, had rid themselves of the clutter of small independencies and become nations. Only Italy, more civilized and in every other respect more modern than any, clung to its patch quilt of jealous little states, undercutting each other. So France was encroaching from the north while Spain reached up from the south, and the candles of Italy, which united would have made a proud free torch, were going out one by one or timidly burning at the pleasure of these foreign powers. It made a man sick, and then it goes on there. and that's one of the interesting things I found about the style of this book, is every now and then the author kind of steps out of it. And it says, yes, I'm here in 1947 and I'm talking to you. You know, this that seems like a paragraph in that way. You know, he's completely out of the story and, you know, take the World Tide, for instance, is how it started. And he steps out and then he talks just for a little bit. And then he says, okay, now back to the story. And that's an interesting choice. But it worked. It worked very well.
Oh, yeah, because one of those I actually had marked, and it was talking about the papacy at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a similar thing where basically he did pick one of the most interesting times to write about because Andrea works for basically Cesar Borgia.
Mm-hmm.
And his father, Cesar's father, is, well, let's see, Alexander, Pope Alexander. I can't remember which
Pope. Yeah, I think it's Alexander VI.
Okay, well.
Yeah, I just have that because I looked it up. I don't think it said 6 in there.
Yeah. I was like, wow, you are good.
Thank you very much, yes.
Yeah, well, you're welcome. He is the Pope, one of those that everybody loves to point at if they're talking about bad popes, which is, you know, he had a mistress, he had children, he actively used the papacy for his own purposes and nothing else.
Yeah.
And he was saying, in that word prince lay most of the difference between their conception of the pope and that of earlier or later times. In him, the vicar of Christ had declined into a temporal sovereign. Alexander ruled over provinces and cities, had armies in his pay, contracted alliances with or against kings and emperors. The house of Borgia concerned him rather than the household of faith. Victim as well as exploiter of a relatively brief historical epoch, he was no more typical of the papacy than is a fungus typical of the mighty oak to which it may be attached. Contemporary and modern Catholic historians of the Church have adequately condemned him. Sensual, shallow, and greedy, he merits no defense except as the creature of his times, which contributed to his sins and made them possible. And then he goes back into the story, but it's those brief paragraphs like that that kind of, they're wonderful because they take out all that judgment that you'll find, I think, in a lot of modern writing about whether it's, you know, historical events or people like this. He kind of will just step aside and go, okay, in context, this guy was, you know, not a great guy.
Right.
But here's why, moving on. And then, because you're just sitting there going, whoa, he is awful.
Yeah, he was awful.
but that's kind of the style of storytelling that he's got, although usually it's told from the point of view of one of the characters, one of the two main characters, who is Andrea Orsini or Mario Belli. And it's not, I guess, that much of a spoiler because it happens in like the first chapter or two. Andrea is an artist, but he doesn't want to admit it. So we meet him in an artist shop because he's really a statesman. He's concerned with moving up in the world. And he meets Mario when Mario tries to assassinate him before he's able to go and contract an alliance with, the Borgia's daughter. I can't remember.
Yeah, Lucretia.
Yeah, that's it.
I can't remember how to pronounce her name.
Yeah, Lucretia Borgia with a state who her brother, Cesar Borgia, wants to absorb into his vision of unifying Italy into one power.
Right.
And everything that takes place is always against this overarching idea of what is the means to an end worth?
Yeah.
Unifying Italy is a wonderful cause, but is it worth going through it in this underhanded way that Cesar Borgia is using and that Andrea Orsini is the main person that we watch doing it? And he is a supreme statesman.
Yeah, and he's constantly torn between what's right and his ambition because he at the same time he wants he's making these conniving decisions all the time. And it's clear he even says to himself, well, what is the next move now? I mean, he's clearly thinking as if this was like a big chess game or something. And he wants to end up on the side of whatever state wins and gets to take over all of Italy. But at the same time, he has these moments where he's like, boy, this is just not right. things are going badly or, you know, these are not moral people and I'm having a problem with being on their side, even though they're winning.
Right. And he doesn't have that problem for a long time because most people are like him. All the people of power are pretty much conniving as well. Mm-hmm. And they're not giving him anything else to look at. He doesn't, he comes from lowly background, and his big ambition is to become a great person. Mm-hmm. And the only example he's ever seen of a great person are people like the rulers of the day. And they're pretty much conniving. That's a wonderful word. They spy, they poison each other, they promise people in marriage, and then, you know, kill off somebody's young husband so they can remarry their daughter to someone else. And they all kind of understand each other this way. Mm-hmm. Then as he goes along, he comes into contact with Mario Belli, who is unable to kill him. And when he says, wow, you'd be a great asset to me. Why don't you be my servant, basically? And you could help me on my mission. And Mario mm-hmm. Belli says, yes, I'll do that thing, because you seem like somebody who'll move along in the world. And as they go along, their conversations are interesting, because one of Mario Belli's chief features is that he looks like Judas.
Hmm.
Basically the personification, that's the word I want, of Judas. He's very, very ugly. And everyone judges him based on that. It doesn't matter that his manners are wonderful or he was raised in a noble household. They all kind of cringe and step away from him. And that has formed a lot of his character. He doesn't trust anyone.
And by contrast, Andrea Orsini, Mario tells him, hey, you look like St. George, and gives him that medal. Says, hey, people will notice this similarity. And that'll be to your advantage.
Right. He's noble. He's good looking. He's got all the qualities that you'd want of a gentleman of the day. He's a wonderful swordsman, everything. Mm-hmm. So he's been promised as a reward the small duchy, I guess you would call it, of Città del Monte, which is what, Citadel of the Mountains, something like that it translates into. And he's also been promised the young and beautiful wife of the old lord. And there, everybody's going, she's probably still completely a maiden, if you know what I mean. I'm sure that old guy couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
And so he is just really anticipating this. And not in any evil way, but just like, wow, I can't wait for this place to be mine and a gorgeous wife. And yeah, I've got to kill the old guy, but whatever, that's how you do things. And when he, in the course of his journey, not only does he meet Mario, who changes how he thinks about things, he meets a purported saint who has a conversation with him that kind of startles him and makes him look at the world with new eyes, not permanently, but just it shakes him from that self-confidence of this way is the only way.
Yeah.
And then when he meets the people who he's supposed to marry, the wife, Camilla Baglioni, I guess is how you'd say it, and her husband, he suddenly realizes these are the first truly good people he's ever met in his whole life. They are completely the kind of people you'd want for a ruler. They're doing things. Yes, they're taking advantage of the good things. They've got the nice castle and the nice clothes, but they truly love the people that they rule, and everything they do is meant for their own good.
Yeah, and the people love them back.
Yeah, and the people see it and love them. They don't tax them to death. They move among the people a lot, and that's when he suddenly really says, oh, what I have to do is not a very nice thing. He always knew it, but he'd never seen that contrast.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the story really starts to get interesting, because his conflict within is extreme.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, one of the most interesting things about this book to me, you know, was as I was reading it, realizing, you know, hey, the Borgias were real. And then I started to look at, you know, I didn't get a chance to look up everything I wanted to look up, like the saint.
Oh, yeah.
Blessed Lucia, was she real?
I don't know.
Yeah, so I'm not positive, but I'm definitely going to go look it up, because it appears to me, you know, I'm going to suspect that she is real, just because from what I've found so far, the main character, Andrea Orsini, and his what becomes kind of his sidekick, Mario Belli, those two don't appear to be real historical characters.
Right.
But almost everybody else, well, everybody else so far that I've looked up that's in the book is real.
And so are the events.
And the events that they, that they're moving around in. Because right around 1500 and, you know, the Renaissance is in full swing. And, you know, all the nation states in Italy, I mean, that's real history. How, you know, Europe was kind of pulling itself together and Italy was still all fractured. And Pope Alexander, of course, was real. You know, and a lot of the things that he did.
Well, and a lot of the things they describe in terms of at one point he's in a place that's being besieged and they're ready to be attacked. And then they realize that actually somewhere else got attacked instead. I think all those little events are actually true because I know that one time, the one I know I knew better at the time was the Captain of Castile. And Rose, my youngest daughter, was having to do a report on the Aztecs and how Cortez conquered them and everything. And she started telling me all these events and all these little towns and his progress. And I was like, oh my gosh, then did this happen and that? And she went, how do you know this? And I said, because I've almost memorized this book. And that's when I discovered he actually brought to life all these real events by putting these characters in it and their conflicts and their interests and having us be fascinated by their adventure. And boy, talk about an easy way to learn history.
Yeah, yeah, for
and
certain.
Put you in the time period. And I think all the attitudes that he portrays are also fairly real because he keeps, as we've said, through these little asides, he'll step out and go, well, you know, that wasn't really the right way to think about it as we would see it, but here's why they thought that way. And then he'll go back into the story. And I fear we're making it sound like a really dry book.
Oh, heavens no, yeah.
But it's really Andrea's personal story of how does he meet the woman he comes to love? Can he betray her husband, Verano, I believe is his name, because now it's early and I've forgotten everything.
Lord Verano.
Verano, and who is a truly a person, the father figure he didn't ever have and wanted. And also what's surprising, and it's because it's of the time too, woven throughout this is a real look at what does it mean to have faith in God. They talk about religion all the time because that was part of the feature of the time too. It was taken for granted. You went to mass, you know, you wanted a saint to live in your town because that made it better than the town next door. But you didn't really believe it if you were those guys. And that's a lot like you see people do today. And so part of what makes Verano and Baglioni so, or Camilla Baglioni, the wife, so interesting is that they are actually true believers. They're practical believers, but they really believe. When it's time to go to Rome for pilgrimage, they're like, well, that's what we're going to do. You know? If our lives are at danger, well, that's too bad. We'll just see how it works, but we're doing what God wants. And so various characters, because of their personal needs or the journey they're on, will show a true way to faith, some more directly than others, like that Saint Lucia who pops up every so often, and some tangentially. But it's never doubted that there's a real truth to that. And it's kind of like one of those old movies where people would stop and pray or a beam of light would come down and they go, oh, God, you're there. It doesn't really overtake the story if you're not really looking for it. Because I read these when, you know, I didn't believe in anything. Yeah, that was part of the story. That was fine. It didn't convert me and I didn't really care. It was just a truth for these characters.
Yeah.
But when you read it as a Christian, what said there is so much truth.
Right. And it's, you know, it was nowhere near dry ever. The book is split up into, what, five sections? Five sections. And my favorite section had to be where they went to get the saint. Now, I forgot who he was doing this for, but somebody said, don't you love this city? You know, our city is so excellent, but what the only thing that we're missing is a saint.
Yeah.
And would you go grab me one?
Yeah. Is the Duke of, or the whoever the ruler of Ferrara is, and that's
uh-huh. he's been right, sent, Ferrara, that's it.
Yeah.
Yep.
When the book starts, he's been sent to work a deal to where he'll get Lucretia Borgia engaged to the actual ruler of Ferrara. Well, it turns out his father actually is the real power behind what's going on, and very much an influencer. And he wants to get rid of Andrea because they don't want to turn their own political path, which is they're interested in merging with France,
mm-hmm.
off kilter. And he's laid out the city in this beautiful geographical, or I guess geometric design is the word I want, because they keep hearkening back also, it was the Renaissance, and they were very much alive to all the architecture and art and everything that made life richer and better. Mm. And he said, you know, this whole city, it's meant to be a monument to God, which is really ironic when you consider how corrupt they all were. And he goes, but we do need a saint. And Viterbo, they've got a saint, and they won't let her go. And she wants to come. We've gotten letters. We bribed her uncle. He's on the good side.
Mm-hmm.
Stupid citizens. They won't let her go. They've got her walled up. So he sends Andrea and Mario to sneak her out. And he's doing this with the view of, and I'll get rid of you too. If you get caught, well, too bad. So yeah. They go off to.
And it could have been straight out of a movie, you know, in modern times. Mm-hmm. There was comedy, there was all kinds of things going on there. And then how the deed actually takes place, you know, when they actually first meet the saint, you know, how, you know, stunning she is, spiritually, and, all these things, you know, they turn into bumbling idiots a little bit, and, and then how it all ends up. But yeah, it's not dry at all. So, you know, it's exciting. It's funny in a lot of places.
Oh, yeah.
And
then he winds up going to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah,
Rome after that.
Yeah, he's trying to protect, because he's met Camilla. He meets, you know, Lord Verano, her husband. And he suddenly, even though he hasn't really decided not to do his plan, he suddenly says, you know, don't do that pilgrimage. I know how this is going to work. I know exactly the thinking. You're going to get killed there. And they're like, no, we've had invitations from the Pope himself. And he's thinking, yes, Cesar Borgia's father. They don't care. They're going to do their duty. And so he goes to Rome hoping he can stop this. And that's when you find out, oh, he's been dating Lucretia Borgia's cousin.
Mm-hmm.
Who very much interested in him, and she becomes quite jealous of what she perceives as his interest in Camilla Baglioni. So then there's this whole section of skullduggery going on and intrigue.
Right. And I was flipping through here, and I found this conversation between Angela and Lucretia.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was interesting to me. And this is the kind of thing I found throughout this book. Mm-hmm. Angela says, and my lord Caesar does not let scruples influence policy. He knows what he wants and where he is going. Quite a man. And Lucretia gets up from her writing desk and says, yes, but isn't there such a thing as God? And then Angela says, I'm not very good at theology, darling. I see what you mean. But as far as it goes, isn't the Pope God's viceroy on earth? Doesn't he hold the two keys? I shouldn't think you deny that he had the power to absolve my lord Caesar in this affair. And then Lucretia says, no, that's true. I don't understand these things. My mind gets lost. Only still, I feel it was wrong. Strange how thinking and feeling are different.
Wow,
and
yeah.
Like that, yeah.
Especially when you look at the fact that what they were talking about is her young husband had been killed.
Mm-hmm.
For matters of policy.
That's right,
for matters of policy.
Yep.
And she nursed him back to health. And then she said one day her brother came in and just stood looking down at him. And she said, my lord turned pale and I knew what it meant. And he was poisoned. And so she had been sent away into exile because she mourned him too publicly, because she actually had loved him as much as her shallow nature would allow her. And that's when she's going, well, but I just feel that was wrong to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And her cousin's like, oh, the Pope said it was all right, so don't worry.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's those two personalities and those little snippets of, you know, how easily it would be dismissed or considered, but it would be considered.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Right. And I would have to say that the one of the things, you know, you mentioned this earlier, that we as Catholics are things that are brought up to us all the time are things like popes doing things that are not good.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the obvious answer to that question is, well, he's just a person. You know, so are the cardinals, so are the bishops. They're just people. Mm-hmm. I mean, no matter how much we want them to be not people, you know,
right.
We want them to be above reproach. They're still just these guys. You know?
Well, yeah, and especially now, you know, you've got all the scandals mm-hmm. with everything going on, and but yet we still see the personalities of the people. It's, you know, every age has its trials,
mm-hmm.
and this is obviously our age's trials, is that people made terrible decisions and did things that most normal people would go, what are you, an idiot?
Mm-hmm.
You know, moving around somebody who's a known predator and taking advice, but they were taking advice from various people and, you know, making decisions based on bad priorities and everything else. And so now that's trying to be cleaned up, but it's left this stain
mm-hmm.
that we all share. And that's the kind of thing that we see in this book, too. It's each individual also is, I don't know, there's a mystery of the church being an entity of God,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time being made up of all these people
yeah.
who are sinners.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, one of the things that's forgotten is there's never a shortage of good people.
Right.
It's just that that's not what we write about. That's not what we read about, you know? But they're always there, and they
yeah.
always push the church forward, and the church always comes out the other end.
Well, yeah, and for all the bad stuff that we get seen splashed around, you know, you look at, what is that, a shameful, like, what, 5% or something?
Mm-hmm.
So that means there's 95% of the yeah. priests are doing the right thing,
yeah,
or whatever
yeah, for
percentage
certain.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, and the bishops and whoever.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not the way to look at that. And also people like to say, well, if he's infallible, this horrible person, how could he be infallible? And that's actually, to me, I look at that and I kind of go, this kind of exemplifies the miracle that is God watching over the church,
mm-hmm.
which is that the Pope is only infallible in matters of theology after he's consulted with the rest of the bishops and everything,
right.
or the cardinals.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that works exactly, but...
Mm-hmm.
But people like this didn't mess it up. They didn't change things so that they were wrong.
Yeah.
They were in power,
yeah,
and the theology
true.
Wasn't, you know, screwed up, basically.
Yeah, and one of the powers of fiction is, you know, it's one thing to read about Pope Alexander, but to be reading a scene with him as one of the players in the scene,
mm-hmm.
and then you realize, ooh, you know, I mean, it makes it personal.
Mm-hmm.
But... it also, you know, in reading this book, you know, realize how blessed we have been. I mean, for me, there's been two popes.
Right.
Pope John Paul II and Pope yeah. Benedict XVI. And
mm-hmm.
they're so different, yet mm-hmm. they're both excellent. They're you know, we've been blessed.
Well, yeah. And the interesting thing is that I know Pope Benedict, and I think also John Paul II, both of them viewed themselves as put in place to carry out the true mission of Vatican II,
mm-hmm.
which was not the stuff everybody likes to point at, like liturgical dancers or the mass put into English, but it was to foster a deeper involvement between the people and the liturgy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because everything had gotten kind of brittle and nobody really understood the Latin, and this was to help pull us back into it so
okay.
that we understood it as a prayer and a connection with God. And I think they've really done that, because John Paul II, he was so dynamic and he re-engaged people. And then you have Benedict, who's coming behind him, kind of going, okay, now we're going to finish the new translation of the liturgy. And we're going to, okay, you weren't maybe the best at dealing with the American bishops or some of these things that should have been happening in the seminaries that weren't, which is why we have some of these scandals. Let me just come in and clean all that up.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see that overlapping and the mission there.
Right.
Which, have you ever read the documents? This is off track, but have you ever read the documents of Vatican II?
No, I sure haven't. I have not.
I need to reread them, but a long time ago after I converted, I kept hearing people talk about Vatican II, which I didn't know what that was anyway. And so I went and read them. Mm-hmm. They're really interesting, and they're not at all full of all this other stuff that everybody would leave you with, you know, the spirit of Vatican II. You know, whether people can be liturgical ministers handing out the Eucharist along with the priest, or whether there's dancing up the aisle ahead of the priest, or, you know, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They're really actually very beautifully put.
Good. Yeah. I'll check that out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've looked into some early history, read mm-hmm. a lot of documents, church father documents. One of the books on my to-read list is The Fathers Know Best by Jimmy Akin. I haven't read that, but I really want to.
I know. I saw Jeff Miller's review of that, and I suddenly went, oh, I need that book.
Yeah, I need that book. Yeah, he's got a new one coming out called Mass Revision, which is about the changes mm-hmm. in the Mass. And I think it comes out within a couple of weeks.
Well, and I'll have to look for – I've read two books that were really good about that. One was by Mike Aquilina and Cardinal Wuerl, is that how you say his mm-hmm. name, of Washington. And it kind of takes you through why – we do what we do during the Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of incorporates some of the changes of, you know, the wording. And with just a brief little paragraph before or after that says, well, we're using this word because it really means this instead of what it used to say. And you go, oh, but it's got, as Mike Aquilina is so wonderful at doing, all these little points of, so look, when everybody is going down the aisle to begin the Mass, that's us too. That represents us, the church, on their way to meet Christ. And you go, oh, I think I knew that, but I'd forgotten it. So it provides a lot of good moments for reflection.
Yeah.
And then the other one is called, I think it's called The Prayers of the People. I'll have to send put a link in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's somebody, and I think he's got another one called The Prayers of the Priest, but I haven't gotten that yet. And it was somebody who went through all the prayers, one by one, that the people will say during the new liturgy. And talks about what did the old ones say and what did they mean and what were the changes and why did they change them. And that also was really interesting and provided a lot of moments for personal reflection.
Mm-hmm.
I've got another one by, oh gosh, what's this guy's name? Is it Edward Suri, S-R-I, where it's a biblical look at the Mass. And it's also a book about the new translation. So there's tons of those books out there. And I think practically any of them are good that you get.
Yeah, I listened just last week. I listened to an episode of Catholic Answers. And mm-hmm. Jimmy Akin was on there taking questions and talking about the Mass revisions.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that was interesting.
Well, and actually, our regular Bible study that our priest runs, he has suddenly changed the last few weeks and turned it into looking at the new liturgy. And the USCCB, which is the council, the U.S. Council of Bishops or whatever, they have a video and a study guide sort of thing that they've put out on the new liturgy that they're encouraging parishes to use. I think it's like a $20 DVD, and I don't know what the book that goes with it costs, but we're watching it section by section, and then talking about questions.
Hmm.
And we're going to do that through November,
because
the new liturgy will start at Advent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting to see the way it's presented. For instance, somebody who was on the original translating committee of Latin to English said, well, you know, we always knew we were kind of in a hurry and that some of it wasn't the best put and we'd have to change it. And he says, but you know, it's been 40 or 50 years, and now we're all very attached to it. He goes, but these are more accurate in terms of how the words help us understand and connect to the theology of mm-hmm. understanding God and knowing him better.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see those kind of people talking about it.
Yeah, sure is.
So I'd encourage people, if they're interested at all and their parish isn't doing it, it might be worth seeking out. I don't think it costs a ton.
Yeah, I don't imagine. When I mentioned the early church fathers, I recall reading Justin Martyr,
mm-hmm.
and I think it was from approximately 150 AD,
mm-hmm.
and he was writing a document defending himself and saying, hey, you know, we Christians are really pretty harmless people,
yeah.
but this is what we do, and he was describing Mass. And I remember how struck I was. It's, oh, wow, this really is 2,000 years old, mm-hmm. all the way back to the beginning. And he described, you know, when you read it as a Catholic, you look at it and you say, wow, that's Mass.
I recognize it.
Yeah.
In fact, I think Mike Aquilina has, you know, he loves the Fathers of the Church. And he's got a book called, I think, just called The Fathers. But mm-hmm. he's got another one called something like The Fathers and the Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically has pulled all these sections from the Fathers of the Church and where they are actually describing the Mass or talking about something to do with it. And you just read this book and go, oh my gosh.
Wow. Yeah, I'd like to get that one.
Yeah, because for one of the things is you'll see, you know, for anybody who's listening who's not Catholic, any of us who belong to a big organization, so to speak, there's always these little factions in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get these factions who argue about things to the death, it seems like, of like, do you take communion on the tongue or in the hand? Do you let the priest put it in your hand or do you make him put it on your tongue, which is the old way and considered to be more proper and blah, 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 blah. Well, it was when I was reading one of these really old fathers of the church, and I can't remember who, and he was talking about, and when you take the, you know, the sacred bread or whatever he was calling the Eucharist, make a throne of your hands, sitting one upon the other, just as you would for the king to sit in. And that's when I went, oh, wait. On the tongue isn't the old way. It's the newer way.
It's the newer way, right.
Oh. You know,
that's
and so
fascinating. Yep.
Yeah, there's all kinds of insights like that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, we're really off the book. I'm so sorry.
Oh, we're pretty close to the book still.
talking
history. Yeah, but the way we got on it was we were talking about the Pope and you know, a bad Pope and how that affects us. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, how can we still be Catholic with a bad Pope? That's kind of how I explained it as well. You know, isn't it amazing that things like that did not kill the church? I mean, you know, isn't that incredible? And right now we're going through, you know, a really difficult time. And I know that, you know, it's tragic. A lot of people have left mm-hmm. the church and I had my own problems that mm-hmm. I had to say, you know, okay, you know, it almost strips you back down to, okay, well, what's vitally important. And,
right.
You know, so it is difficult to go through these things when you have, the higher ups that you want to be, above reproach, making bad decisions
yeah.
But the church moves on. The church keeps going.
Well, and it's kind of interesting because even in these jaded times, which I find very equivalent to this, you know, book about the 1500s,
mm-hmm.
or was it 1400s? A long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's right around 1500. Does it ever say exactly? I don't think it says exactly, but it seems to be 1500 is the, the map. That's where I got it from.
Oh,
the map in the front cover says Italy 1500.
It's got this wonderful end paper with the old school map in it. So you can see the Italy of Andrea Orsini.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And I love it. And it's Italy 1500.
Yeah.
And it's got the inset that shows the bigger picture. I mean, it's wonderful.
Yeah, I must have the same edition.
Yeah, I think there is a newer one, but I love these older books like this. And it's so well done. The paper's still holding together just great. Yeah, it was published in 1947.
Yeah, and that's what I've got.
So, what was I saying about all that? Oh, yeah, these really jaded times. And you look at all these bad examples like that Pope. And also there's one of the sons of the Ferraris, if that's how you would say it, ruling family is a cardinal. And he'd been a cardinal since he was like 8 years old or something, because it was just bestowed as a political tool. And Lucrezia Borgia's son is maybe a year old, the baby who's brought to her. And he's like, he's something in the church or he's, I don't know what it is. Like, you know, so they would just misuse this stuff like crazy. But by the contrast in the book, what you see is kind of the way that we're supposed to do it, too. We're supposed to be like the Veranos of the Città del Monte, who are part of society, but they show a better way through their example.
Right.
And you see their people who respond to that because they innately know what the truth is. And so when people hold up the Catholic Church, and we could say, oh, well, it's just like being American. Our rulers do things I hate, and yet I don't leave America. But everybody innately understands that anything to do with religion has to be more true than a political system.
Yes.
You know, so that's a tribute in a way. All the harsh criticism, yes, it's a chance to tear down, and it's taken by a lot of people. But it's also a chance to point out, we expect better. Mm-hmm. We expect more. You should be better.
Yeah.
And we try, but, you know, everybody fails because none of us are perfect.
Right, right. I read Christopher Hitchens' book, God Is Not Great.
Oh, did you?
I did, yeah. And it's what it is a parade of Christians acting badly.
Oh,
That's really what his whole tack is, you know, Christians pretty much stink. So how could Christianity be real? And he doesn't attack just the Catholic Church is part of it, you know, Protestants, you know, the LDS mm-hmm. Church has its own particular section.
And, right.
But that's what it is a parade.
He's a universal hater.
Yeah, he is.
That's nice to know. They're no particular target.
That's right.
I know he's not a fan of, I think, isn't he the one who wrote those books about Mother Teresa or something?
That I don't know.
There's somebody like that who's, she took money from these awful peoples or whatever else it was that she did. I don't know that they didn't like.
Yeah, yeah.
But
that's his whole thing, you know, with all this, the new atheism that's out there, you know, it's mm-hmm. becoming so popular. And so I read the book mm-hmm. and, but that's what it was, he really didn't have anything to say about it other than, you know, look how terrible these people are. And how could the rest of it be true? That's pretty much what he said.
But yet he didn't go find any examples of people who are better than they could have been.
No, absolutely not. There wasn't an example in there of religion in any way helping humanity do anything.
Right.
Now, his brother, Peter Hitchens, is a Catholic.
Right.
And he went from atheism to Catholicism.
Right.
And he wrote a book called The Rage Against God, How Atheism Brought Me to Faith. Now, I've read only a synopsis of that book, and I do want to read that book, but the synopsis tells us that he's saying, well, if you look at he says, you know, religion has, but it's pretty much the Catholic Church in history. You know, everything else is, considerably more recent.
mm-hmm,
but how the positive effect of religion, you know, he starts to illustrate that in his book is what I'm
it was a civilizing factor.
It had a incredible positive influence.
There was
a lot of stuff that happened. I mean, that.
Yeah. Well, people make terrible decisions a lot of times, and sometimes for the best of motives, sometimes for the worst, mm-hmm. and it has a multiplying effect. And I think we talked about this maybe last time or the time before of that. You know, you start to see how the sins of one person can have a ripple effect through everyone they might not have even met.
Mm-hmm.
And it's harder to know that when I completely lose my temper and scream at somebody, not that I would ever do that, but it can affect somebody in Africa, you know, because the whole point is that we're all one body. And so what one of us does affects everyone. But if that, you could see how it ripples.
Mm-hmm.
The person I scream at may turn around and do something else. And I just think it's an interesting fact that my parents, who were atheists, never worried about the bad things that people who were Christians might do.
Mm-hmm.
They never brought it up. And I think because of that, I took that effect or that idea that, well, we're all people.
Yeah.
You know, there's some horrible people. There's some jerks. And then they're the ones like my grandfather, who was Christian and I think Methodist or something. But they never, and my grandmother also, but my grandfather is the one that we all say he'll never be recognized except by the people who knew him, but he was a saint. He was a real saint.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, not doing miracles, but just in the way he lived so consistently and such a good person. And he brought light into every life that he touched. And those are the people that Christopher Hitchens are his eyes even open to see them? Or is he like Mario Belli or Andrea Orsini,
mm-hmm.
who is blind to that until something smacks him in the head? Mario Belli is looking for light. He's had such a horrible life, always judged because of his looks.
Yeah.
Always pushed down, had to escape to another country, take on a pseudonym. And it isn't until extreme events push unusual people into his path, like the saint, like the midget, who I can't remember her name, who's in the court at Città del Monte.
Right, yeah.
Who becomes his friend, who has a... They don't really ever tell a lot about her, but it's clear she's had an influence on him for good.
Mm-hmm.
That he suddenly starts thinking, I can see the stars. I am worthy to be a better person or do something different. And Andrea, we see much more of his personal development.
Yeah, that is something about this book, too, is Andrea has a path that he takes in it. I guess you could call it a spiritual path.
Yeah.
But he's not the same person at the end as he is at the beginning. And I know, I mean, a lot of novels do that, but you know,
right.
the whole path was very interesting and satisfying.
Yeah. And it made a lot of points about trying to pretend to be someone you're not, not valuing the gifts that you've been given
mm-hmm.
when everybody else around you can see them. But you yourself are so bound and determined to have something that is not really right for you.
Mm-hmm.
But then he can't avoid seeing the truth, even when he wants to be dishonest to himself. The qualities of the people around him who are true to what they are and what they should be are so bright that he finds himself reexamining things, and he'll stop and go, oh my goodness, how could this be? I was wrong about this.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not open to it. I mean, thinks he's on a fine journey. And he is going to have a great time. He's going to be the Lord, betray people, whatever. That's what it takes, because the good things in life are what I want. And he gets derailed. And he himself wouldn't talk about it as a journey of faith, but that's so interwoven because of these people he meets and the examples that it is. I mean, this is a wonderful example of how to tell a rich, full story that has all the components of being life-changing, but mm-hmm. without smacking you over the head with it.
Yeah, for certain. For
you know?
Certain. Yep. Right. I agree.
And there's swashbuckling, there's mm-hmm. bandits, there's...
there's saint stealing.
Yes. There's... How can you have a book without saint stealing, really?
Right. No? And, you know, there's an excellent Wikipedia entry on this book.
Oh,
and,
really?
And in there, it has a little list of characters. So I clicked on the saint's name, and she is real.
Okay.
Lucia Brocadelli of Narni.
Okay.
And it says she was the eldest of 11 children of Bartolomeo Brocadelli and Gentilina Cassio. When she was only 5 years old, she had a vision of the Virgin Mary. 2 years later, she had another vision, this time of the Virgin Mary accompanied by Saint Dominic. And anyway, it goes on, but she's real. So, and it even says right here, Lucia's departure precipitated a conflict between Ferrara and Viterbo, which would continue for 2 years. So,
I mean,
Viterbo wanted to keep the famous mystic for themselves, and the Duke wanted her in Ferrara.
And I think one of the most amazing things about this book is in this age of revisionist history, this guy, Samuel A. Schellenberger, God bless him, he took this series of events and wove it into a fascinating, swashbuckling adventure tale that's absolutely true to the history, but without... People are judged, but they're people that anybody would look at and judge. Everybody looks at that Pope and goes, oy vey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Andrea's journey and the other little characters that he invented are there not only to tell the history, but to show, I don't know, a better way.
Mm-hmm.
How should you be as a person? And people like... Saint Lucia, she says at one point, I mean, it's the questions that people still ask today. Like one of the questions, and this is one that I'll go, yeah, no kidding. Oh, let's pray to God for a victory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that we'll win over the bad guys. And she is, and this is a spoiler, she stops at a city under siege, which is Andrea Orsini is in. And they're saying, oh, we're under siege. Oh, thank goodness you're here. Your presence has assured us your victory. And it says, ah, Messeri of the world, she reproved. I see you have made progress since our first meeting, but you still have far to go. I did not speak of victory, but of comfort. Do not deceive the people, fratello mio, with the illusion that God wars on one side or the other. You cannot know that, nor can I. He speaks to you and to your enemy alike. If you both obey him, to both of you will be given victory. But see, it's not the victory they're thinking of.
Yeah.
And so that's just dropping that little nugget in there.
Right.
And then she, and then they say, oh, can we ask you a question? How do you learn to know the voice of God? How can you be sure he's spoken? Does it come by practice? Is it a gift, a miracle? And she says, she was silent a moment, her bandaged head resting on Alda's head, her bandaged hand resting on Alda's head. Everything is a gift, she said at last, timidly. Everything is a miracle. But the greatest of all miracles is love. I can only say that I love and that more and more I hear the voice of my beloved. And that's the victory.
Wow. Yep.
You know, she doesn't say that, but that's what you're left with. And then it just goes on into, okay, and now so-and-so is getting ready to attack.
Mm-hmm.
And the big battle begins, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this book has got everything that an old swashbuckling movie has. And like I say, these things that I pulled out just now, these are just little nuggets dropped in there. And it's true to the way that those people would have thought about it. But it's also very true to those of us who are reading it going, oh, there's something else in this book I didn't expect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Now, when long time ago, you and I had a short discussion about a book called Pillars of Earth.
Yes.
And I know it's not a book that you're fond of, but it's kind of it's a famous historical novel.
Many people love it.
Yeah. So what do you think the contrast is between this one and that one?
I think that although the author it's pronounced Follett, not Follett.
Oh, I think it's Follett.
Ken Follett.
I would say Follett.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ken Follett wrote it, and he was trying very hard to be accurate historically, and I was very interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got partway into it, what I discovered is it seemed to me to be way too modern in the way that everybody was thinking, and way too much dwelling on, you know, perversions is what I would call it. Mm-hmm. Like the person who's being a peeping Tom on some girl that he's got an obsession over.
Mm-hmm.
And the things he was thinking about doing to her and the things he couldn't wait for this and that. And I'm like, okay, this is not adding anything to the story. And maybe somebody of that time would have thought that way, but I don't think they would have expressed it that way. Maybe they would have. Right. I didn't want to know it. I didn't care. I understand he's stalking her. I get that. That's okay. Mm-hmm. And then there was some other character who was a female who was, I can't remember what she was doing. Cause halfway through, I just went, you know, I don't. It's too much modernization for me.
I'm with you there. Yeah, and it's interesting how Schellebarger, he doesn't do that. And well, this is kind of, if you call Eiffelheim a historical novel, which I do, even though it's science fiction.
Right.
I mean, we've read two really, accurate historical novels. And by accurate, I mean that the authors really took pains to try and make the characters think like they think then.
Right.
You know, and that's excellent.
Well, and it makes me think also, I have another favorite historical fiction author who is Kenneth Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
He's not much known these days, and it's a shame. And I wouldn't probably suggest him for this particular podcast because there's nothing to do with faith and honest about it, his characterization for people is not possibly as good as it could be, but they're really historically accurate. And he'll do the same thing of inserting his own characters into American history is what he's interested in, early American history.
Oh.
And he wrote a book in, I think it might've been 1957 called Oliver Wiswell that rocked American history and started this huge argument. Because basically, Oliver Wiswell is a Tory, and he tells the story of the American Revolution from a Tory's point of view, living in New England, and the whole war is played out, of course, with him being pulled into interesting segments of it with his little band of friends and acquaintances. But the thing is what he showed was, I think for the first time, is accurate portrayals of the battles.
Hmm.
You know, oh, instead of standing fast, the Americans, and I can't remember what battle it was, so Bunker's Hill might not be right. It's just a famous one that comes to mind. Halfway through, they turned around and ran. Hmm. But General, yeah, let's pick another famous general. I'm sure I'm getting wrong. General Gage, who was being urged to go forward and catch them, was much more interested in flirting with this very beautiful woman who'd been married lady, who'd promised him she'd go on a picnic with him and maybe something else, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. So he wasn't interested. He said, we can get them anytime.
Mm-hmm.
So it was this series of stuff like that. It wasn't showing the Americans as the strong, heroic defenders. It wasn't showing the British to their best advantage, but it was showing it in a way of, well, we could have got him. I was just, you know, we had a stupid general.
Mm-hmm.
And he never said anything bad about George Washington, but I think that's because he just didn't find anything bad about him.
Hmm.
From what I can tell, that's kind of how that guy was. But he does that again and again, and people couldn't stand in 1957 or whatever it was, having those ideas of who people were punctured. But he did it in a way that was very accurate, but still very true to the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that book, The Pillars of Earth, had been done that way, I wouldn't have had a problem with it, because he was actually being fairly nice most of the time to the religious people in the book.
Uh-huh.
You know, he wasn't picking on them unnecessarily. It felt modern.
Yeah. Interesting.
It didn't feel true to the time. Mm-hmm. And I wish I had found another current, well, like you say, Michael Flynn's mm-hmm. book.
Yeah, Michael Flynn's good.
That felt very true.
My favorite historical novel to date is The Killer Angels by Michael Schirra. Have you ever read that one?
I've never heard of that.
Oh, it's
okay.
Really terrific. It's about the Battle of Gettysburg.
Oh,
but
okay.
Incredibly moving
book. But
it's
historical book. Fiction?
Yeah, it's okay. Historical fiction.
How
yeah.
do you spell his last name?
Well, I guess Schaara.
Huh, okay.
And his son has continued writing books. His name is Jeff Schirra, and
okay.
he's been writing. He wrote some about the American Revolution and some about World War II. I haven't read any of those, but
okay.
This one, The Killer Angels, is excellent.
Okay.
Yeah, well, and it does the same thing. You know, everybody in there's definitely thinking like they thought back then, and it's tragic, you know, brother against brother, you know?
Yeah. And Oliver was, well, much the same. And the other books that this guy would write, there's usually, Kenneth Roberts is a little more limited in his scope than Samuel Shellabarger. His characters aren't as flexible. You tend in different books to see the same type of a character, kind mm-hmm. of like reading Dick Francis mysteries.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's always somebody who is the main character and he's always got the same qualities, but they're put in these interesting historical situations.
Yeah.
I had hoped one time to read on Forgotten Classics a book called, I think it's Lydia Bailey, which is a true retelling of the, is it the Haitian uprising? The original one that threw off the French colonists.
Mm-hmm.
And a fascinating book. That's my best way to learn about history.
Yeah.
You gotta tell me a story.
Yeah, certainly.
And this I highly recommend, because if you don't care, you know, if you're listening and you're not Christian or you don't care about it, the message, the religious message isn't huge. I mean, it isn't a hit over the head thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of one of the many threads, because a big one also is nationalism. It keeps coming back to, it was so important for Italy to be a state, but was this the right way to do it? Was this going to achieve the results if it was done this way? Does the end justify the means?
Mm-hmm.
And that's also a big story in a big theme of his books. It tends to be that way.
Okay.
He only wrote 4 of those historical novels, but they're all really good.
Great. Well, I'd definitely be up for another one. I sure enjoyed it.
Oh, good. Well, much later when we've recovered from the intensive reading, because it's a big book.
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, it was good, but I should mention that. You know, we've talked about Game of Thrones before, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I was struck, you know, I've read historical fiction before, but this time for some reason, because Game of Thrones was on my mind because we had talked about it not long ago.
Right.
There's a lot of similarities there between epic fantasy and historical fiction. You have to build the world in both places, but right. it feels like the same genre sometimes. And Game of Thrones, you know, the television show has a lot of sexual content in it. And I only watched the first episode. I'm told it got better and is excellent. So I may try it again, but someone in our office
mm-hmm. said that they had the last episode, and he goes, "I'm going to read the book now. Uh-huh. It was so good. He liked it that much.
Yeah, but the book, I really enjoyed the books, and there is some sexual content in the books too. I mean, they didn't get it from nowhere. But the whole book is about the political maneuverings of all of these people, the book Game of Thrones. And Prince of Foxes was very similar in that way. Mm-hmm. So, George R. R. Martin got it from history, you know.
Right.
And from there, you know, just all the machinations these guys do to try and get their families in a position where they've got power. And then against the backdrop of a fantasy world where there's a little bit of magic, not too much. And then some growing threat from the north that they keep saying winter is coming. And when they say winter is coming, there's actually something, you know, in the first novel, it's there a little bit. In the second, it's a little more, you know, it's something is coming to threaten them all. So
well, I heard Guys Can Read, mm-hmm. which is a podcast I highly recommend to anyone who just loves books. They talked about that book recently.
Mm-hmm.
And they made it sound interesting, except that the point they said was that he kept introducing character after character after character after character, and it got very difficult for them to keep track of. And I would say that although this book it's 400 pages long and the type is not big, mm-hmm. and it's dense with that historical information because you have to have it. Mm-hmm. You can't strip this. Well, you could strip the story down, but you need all this to understand the full context of what's going on.
Yeah.
From the character's mindset and to understand that time period. And it really is history plus fiction. I mean, it's like reading a history book, but they really follow you meet a lot of characters, but because you're really just following a couple of characters mainly, it's maybe a little easier to get through.
Yeah. Yep.
Maybe get through is the wrong word, but follow.
Yeah.
I don't want to make it sound
probably so. Right. Right.
I've only read it about 5 times, so clearly I don't have a problem with it. So
yeah, it was great. Enjoyed it. So thanks. Yep.
Oh, I'm glad you liked it.
I did.
Well, I highly recommend also The Captain of Castile.
Okay.
That's the one we'll have to read sometime because that's got the Spanish Inquisition.
Ooh. And nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah, nobody does, except everybody where this kid comes from, they do.
All right.
So.
All right.
Okay.
Okay, so what's coming up next?
Let's see.
It's a movie.
Your movie, right?
Yeah, Groundhog Day.
A wonderful one.
Yeah, that'll be fun to talk about.
Yes.
That'll be a hoot. And then after that, we're going to talk about East of Eden by John Steinbeck.
I know. I'm nervous. I'm afraid of Steinbeck. So.
Oh, you shouldn't be afraid of Steinbeck. He's one of my favorite writers. And East of Eden is straight out of Genesis. So we'll get to talk a little bit about the Old Testament. I'd love to talk about something that I want to talk about during that podcast is how do we as Christians view the Old Testament? How is the Old Testament affect us? Mm-hmm. You know, so I want to talk about that during that podcast.
I'm ready.
Excellent.
Well, considering that I'm reading it on Forgotten Classics, yes, you bet. About that a lot.
Yeah, that's great. I'm looking forward to talking about that. And then what's after that?
Let's see. And then I was going for a summer movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because that'll be about August. Golly, right. Inception.
Yeah. Inception. Oh, fantastic.
Layer upon layer in a big summer movie, but it'll hurt your brain if you're not ready for it. I have a friend who wasn't prepared for it somehow, and he won't even talk about it. I'm like, what? Well, wasn't that bad? I said it was great. And he goes, did you understand it? And I was like, how could you not understand it? So clearly there's two ways of thinking about that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then... Oh, because you were talking about Mysteries, and Then There Were None by Agatha Christie.
That's great.
Going old school.
Yes. Neat.
I did want to, we'd gotten some feedback.
Oh, good.
from Will Duquette.
Oh, that's right. Yep.
On the Mystery of Grace. Stuff. I didn't know if...
Yes.
What I appreciated is he went to the trouble to write. He went to the trouble of getting the Mystery of Grace to read before he listened to our podcast. And I was like, that is so much trust, Will.
Thank you. That is great. Yeah.
Wow. I'm not sure we deserve it, but we appreciate it. But then he was saying that I'm just going to read this because I thought this was something we try to do, and so I appreciated the affirmation. He says, what I want to congratulate you both on is something you're both really good at. In the mystery of, or sorry, I skipped ahead, that I wish I was good at. As a lay Dominican, it's something I really ought to be good at, which is accepting and rejoicing in truth where you find it without letting the place you find it bog you down. In the mystery of grace, for example, you're pulling out the things that make sense given a Catholic worldview. My tendency would be to point out the things that don't. In fact, my tendency would be to get out my analytical scalpel and cut the poor thing to shreds, trying to cut out all of the stuff that's wrong and retain all the stuff that's right and make the difference absolutely clear to the probably nauseated listener. The trouble is, a work of fiction is not a theological... is not a theological treatise. Trying to dissect it that way does violence to the poetic imagery used to approach the mysteries of life. It's an abuse of the book. What's worse, you can do the same thing to people whose views you disagree with. Your approach is much gentler, more helpful, and more likely to draw people into the mystery you're talking about. So good on ya, as the Aussies say. I'm trying to learn from your example, which... Mm. I hope you don't mind me reading that, Will. I didn't say I was going to, but...
Oh, that's nice. Yep.
That's so nice.
It is. It's fantastic.
And I think that's a tendency that... I kind of have that particular tendency towards things within the Catholic Church, like the new liturgy coming up, or those differences I was talking about, where do you take the Eucharist on the hand or on the tongue? And so I have to try to guard myself into going, you know, the church allows all these things.
Mm-hmm.
It's my way is not necessarily the right way for everyone. And so I think we all struggle with that in different places, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, for certain.
So it's nice to know that we're not having that problem here.
That is, it is. We had another comment from Patty, Pretentious Wombat.
Yes.
In our last podcast about a boy, she said, your Twilight remarks totally made my day, which made my day.
Yeah,
I have often toyed with the idea of writing an essay on what a poor role model Bella makes for young girls due to her always deferring to others and not standing up for herself. But yeah, thank you for that comment. Because, yeah, you know what's interesting is I noticed on Goodreads that Twilight is near the top of the best books of all time. And near the top of the worst books of all time. Two different lists.
Yeah. That's so hilarious.
It is. It's good stuff. And then Jeff Miller wrote us a comment. I don't know if you've seen that yet. It was just on there this morning. Let me just say, he said, thank you. This is a movie I never would have seen if not for your recommendation. So after I listened to this episode, I watched it on Netflix. And all I can say is, wow. Just an excellent movie with much to recommend on multiple levels, and it even makes me think better of Hugh Grant.
Poor Hugh Grant, yes.
So thanks, Jeff. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
That was a good movie. That was a good movie.
Yeah, I'm glad he liked it. I'm always, like I say, I'm always surprised at how many people haven't seen it, and it's just so good.
Yeah,
so.
That was one I'd never seen. That was neat.
Yeah, but everybody's heard of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
That I'm always surprised about is that it's well known enough that but nobody's seen it. Well, I guess a lot of people have seen it. We said that before, but hey, you guys, thank you for those comments.
Yes, thank you very much.
We might have gotten one or two others that just were more personally based. I'm thinking I got an email where somebody's like, "Wow, I love what you're doing. Thanks." But you know, it makes my day.
It does. Yeah. Yeah,
it's nice to hear. So we appreciate you taking the time to do it because you do have to take the time to stop and think and go and comment. So
we appreciate that. And
but
thanks
you know,
very
keep
much.
Doing it. Yeah.
Thanks a million for listening, everybody.
Yeah.
And we'll see you in a couple weeks for Groundhog Day.
Oh, yes.
Maybe we'll play that episode over and over and over. I'll make it an 8-hour episode. Just put it back to back to back to back.
Oh, yes. Seeing what little details we can change. So now surely everyone has seen this movie. But if you have not, go see this, you know, find this movie and watch it. Don't wait for us. Good heavens.
It'll be fun to talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely. All right.
Okay.
We'll see you all in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.